Hath not the potter power over the clay, of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor, and another unto dishonor? Romans 9, verse 21. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I hope everyone is safe and sound, at least for those of us living in the American Southeast. It's been a very brutal couple of days, but with the hurricane coming through, I know a lot of people are still out of power and are dealing with massive floods, and will be continuing with the floods in other areas as the week goes by and the water starts running down from the mountain. So everyone, please stay safe. And for those listeners not in the American Southeast, I hope you did have a safe weekend and week as well. And I hope you take care, too. So, let's go ahead and start this episode. I do, again, want to thank everyone for joining me. If you're a newcomer, welcome. Please avail yourself of our backlog of episodes. And if you're a returning listener, thank you. And please enjoy, as you have enjoyed all our other episodes. I did have a little bit of feedback that I wanted to touch on real quick. I had mentioned we could tell occasionally I wouldn't say ethnicity, but what someone's primary language was, what they were taught to speak growing up, typically by their names. Someone asked me how we know that, just from names themselves. A lot of early names, especially in the Middle East, and I believe in Egypt too, are Theophilic. So they kind of, they're in praise of a specific deity or something along those lines. And if a deity belongs to a specific mythological pantheon, you can say, okay, yeah, this person's probably Sumerian or Semitic or Akkadian or whatever. That's what I meant by that. So those type of names, of course, in Europe, you can tell based on the spelling in some cases, if someone's from Western Europe or Eastern Europe, depending on their name. You have other types of names too, occupational, that kind of thing. So you can generally tell at least a region in a lot, even in modern day, though in the past there's less certainty on some of that, but people tend to make educated guesses, say, oh, this person's name's Semitic. So they were either like Akkadian or Ugaritic or what have you, or, oh, their name's Sumerian, they're Sumerian. So just make of that what you will. Now, there are cases where, and these are rarer than not, there are cases where we know for a fact a person, their father's name belonged to one group, and then his name belonged to another group. So he was probably half Sumerian or half Akkadian or something along those lines. Or maybe in the case of kings, he may have had a name prior to being crowned, and then he assumes the name of a different religious group to kind of tie himself in with that. So that does happen too. And I plan on going over names and things like that when we get to them. So just keep aware, just keep on listen out for that. So I hope I've explained that well. Now, with that out of the way, let's go ahead and move on to our topic for this week's episode. We're going to be moving east from where we talked about the last couple of episodes and moving to the northern Euphrates River system and continuing along kind of the bend of the Fertile Crescent all the way to the northern Tigris River and its tributaries. In this strip of land, we will be discussing a period of time known as the Halaf. That said, I do want to preface all this by saying there is some territorial and temporal overlap with this culture and a couple of other cultures that we'll be discussing, too, over the next couple of weeks. So just keep that in mind. Also, there are peoples not associated with any of these cultures that are kind of living in and around the areas we're going to be talking about too. But they don't have anything that necessarily distinguishes them from any other group, so we can't really say who or what they were. Now, to the Halaf period proper. Now, the seeds of this culture had actually already been, at least at a small level, planted towards the end of last season. How long is debated. I've seen some sources say 6500 BC, and others say 6100 BC. And I think the discrepancy comes from the specific sites being discussed and when they were first occupied. Some obviously were occupied a little bit earlier than others, and that's kind of the discrepancy. Like, oh, this is a Halaf site. Well, was it really, or was it just occupied first? So there's always those kind of debates, too. Maybe some random unrelated group occupied the site from 6300 to 6100, and then the Halaf immediately moved in after those people left, or they just adopted Halaf practices. We don't know. But just keep that kind of interaction in mind as well. And again, some are much older than others, but regardless of the exact time, the beginning of the Halaf culture sees their sites become occupied permanently. Though some places had, again, been used at earlier periods, either permanently or seasonally. But you don't see hallmarks of Halaf culture, or at least what we consider the hallmarks of Halaf culture, really begin to take root until around 6000 BC, give or take a century or so. Who knows what they considered most important about themselves. Now, the name Halaf comes from the first type site of this culture that was discovered. This is Tel Halaf. It is about 3 or 4 kilometers southwest from the modern Syrian city of Ras al Ain, which is right on the Turkish-Syrian border. The name itself is actually Aramaic, which, like Arabic, is a Semitic language and means hill of the old city or hill of the former city. We don't know what they called themselves, obviously. Though it should be noted that the site of Halaf was actually probably not the center of this culture. It's kind of in the western portion of the apparent core Halaf territory. Most of the primary, I guess you'd call them, Halaf sites are all kind of concentrated in or around the Tigris River, right where it kind of gets through to the south of the Taurus Mountains. Those are where you'll see the highest concentration of Halaf sites, though they do have a very wide range. Now, the first site was excavated by the German Baron Max von Oppenheim in 1911. He's a very interesting guy, and I kind of hope to talk about him in depth more one day. But he was able to get permission from the Ottoman government, who controlled the region at the time, to excavate the site. And he and his team made a lot of progress and found a large amount of artifacts. Thankfully, his standards were generally ahead of his time, and he led a very careful dig. Sadly, though, a large portion of what he found was destroyed in Berlin during World War II. Now, the reason they were interested in this site was due to a slightly more recent history. Halaf is abandoned around 5400 BC, and it remained so for quite a while. It's not a city again until like the 1500s BC, and it doesn't even really become important as a city until the 1300s. Now, in this later period, it comes to be called Guzana, or as it's known in the Bible, Gozan. And this is one of the places where the Assyrians exiled the Jews after the defeat and capture and sack of the first temple. So this was one of the primary draws to have it excavated, because people believed it could be related to biblical history, which was a very big driving factor in a lot of early archaeological studies in this region. Though that's all in the future, from what we're supposed to be discussing now. I just thought it was an interesting fact. I thought you guys might enjoy it. Now, as I said, Halaf was one of the larger western sites, with a few dotted along the Euphrates to the west, though their pottery and statuary have been found even further west in areas we've discussed the last few weeks, like Proto-Ugarit, though in very small numbers in some of those cases. Now, there are also some sites clustered northwest of Halaf, but these are all north of the Taurus Mountains, and it isn't clear how exactly they're related to the Halaf. They didn't share all of the hallmarks of the Halaf culture, but they had some Halaf-type pottery, statues, tools, etc. So they may have been a type of colony or like a pseudo-trading site. You'll see a lot of, in a lot of Halaf sites, they have jewelry and ornaments, including obsidian or black clay that you would get from this region of Anatolia, or you could get from this region of Anatolia. So this might be one of those sources. Now, these sites in the kind of to the north east of Halaf are Arslan Tepe, Tepeshik, and Nurshun Tepe. Now, the first is located near the Marat River, or it's also known as the Arsanias or the Eastern Euphrates. This is the source river for the more famous Euphrates. And it flows west down from the Armenian highlands, then curves to the south where it begins to be fed by other rivers, creeks, streams, melting snows, coming down from the Taurus, all that stuff. And then it continues kind of south and it kind of meanders through to where it begins to cut through and join kind of parallel to the Tigris, which is where you get the Mesopotamia proper. Now, the second two that I mentioned, Tepeshik and Nurshun Tepe, were located around Lake Hazar, which is the source of the Tigris River, which begins to flow from the lake as a small stream to the southeast of the lake, and then collects, again, other streams, creeks, melting snow, all that kind of stuff. And then it, again, flows down through the Taurus Mountains, though a little bit straighter than the Euphrates does, or at least a more direct line. Now, unfortunately, like some of the earlier Tas Tepler sites, like Göbekli Tepe, or Karahan Tepe, I think is another that we've talked about, these are now both under the man-made Keban Dam Lake. And this was made by damming portions of the Marat River for hydroelectricity. Though these sites and many others from different periods were excavated kind of on an emergency basis for beforehand so they could get a lot of the more obvious and prevalent artifacts for study. Now, there is one more site located in Anatolia north of the Taurus Mountains that has links to the Halaf culture. And this is the eastern portion of the peninsula toward the southeast of Lake Van. It is known as Tilki Tepe, and it is considered a true Halaf site. Those other sites, they have some overlap with the Halaf, but there are some differences. There are some things missing that you would find at other Halaf sites. But Tilki Tepe has everything that you would associate with a Halaf site. Now, I hear you ask, what makes a site a true Halaf site? And first and most obviously is their material culture, specifically their pottery. Now, we've talked a lot about other cultures that have either, you know, very basic utilitarian pottery with no bells or whistles, or basic pottery kind of made with distinct colors, or, you know, small amounts of decoration, things with designs caused by, like, impressing other items into them, like combs or seashells, things like that. Halaf pottery is a step above all these. It could range in color from a simple white or kind of a cream to black to brown or a dark burnt red with all kinds of shades of all those colors kind of in between. And they were painted with a wide variety of different patterns, both geometric and in some cases actual representative images. Things like a honeycomb pattern with dots in the center of the cells, intricate crosses. They would also paint birds, rams, all kinds of other animals. All in far more detail and with much more skill than anything that you see by their nearest neighbors. Now, their neighbors seem to agree. It appears that the pottery was seen as something of a prestige item, and there are examples with individuals far outside of Halaf territory being buried with kind of the cream of the Halaf pottery crop. Now, I should point out that this is something that it does evolve over time. At the start of the Halaf period, pottery from Halaf sites was well made, to be sure, but the designs are still very basic. And as you progress every 100 years or so, you kind of see a jump in the level of design and artistic flair that they add to it. Now, that's not to say that they never make just your average basic pottery. They do. They still do. They make stuff that would not be any more identifiable from one group to another, but they do seem to kind of take a great deal of pride in these special creations, these, I guess you would call it the first fine china that they would bring out, or at least that's the kind of the equivalent it would be. Now, we're not sure why their pottery is so much more well-made or skillfully made, but there have been, chemical analyses done of their pottery, and it shows that they were using a much wider variety of clays and things like that than their neighbors were. It's also theorized that the Halaf valued pottery so much that they may have set up a system where only the best of the best of their craftsmen were allowed to create kind of the high art, or at least decorate their vessels. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to another kind of portion of what makes the Halaf the Halaf. Another thing that they do that's a little bit different is they are making statuary. Nothing huge, but they do have a lot of different kind of representations of animals that they'll make. I saw some that were little porcupines or hedgehogs. They also have an abundance of female-esque figures. At least they have what appears to be a female lower body in either like a cross-legged or kneeling position. It's not 100% what it is. It's kind of a little bit of an abstraction. It has a female upper torso with breasts and sometimes with arms kind of crossed, sometimes not. And then the head is kind of non-existent. It's usually like a conical, kind of meant to say that this is where the head would be. Now, this is probably going to make you think, if you saw them, like, hey, this is kind of similar to maybe what we saw at some of the Toss Tepler sites or Çatalhöyük. And that is a kind of connection that people theorize. That this, not necessarily that these are related peoples, but they may have kind of adopted similar motifs for depicting some type of female or fertility goddess. But again, we don't really know, speculation, but it's a reasonable theory, I think. Of course, that's all it'll probably ever be, is a theory. Now, another distinctive feature of the Halaf was their architecture. They had round houses, tholoi, though again, that's a term used to describe Greek houses during a certain period, and it's used to describe any kind of round house for especially this part of the world, but there is not a direct relation between the later Greek Tholoi type house and these. They just share a similar kind of floor plan, excuse me. Most of their houses were built with domed roofs, and they had kind of built out of sun-dried clay, and some of them were even over 10 meters in diameter. Now, they did not always use this material, but they usually use this material, though occasionally they would throw in local material as well if it was available. Sometimes they would use boulders or limestone, mud, just anything that might be available locally that was not necessarily found elsewhere. In some cases, you would have straw too. Some of the homes were also kind of had these kind of antechambers where they would have like a singular kind of like rectangular entrance area. Some believe that these are possibly more religious institutions or like religious spaces. Some are also built on stone foundations, like they would build like kind of a stone platform and then construct the tholoi. Though there are cases where that may be just a pattern that they eventually decided to adopt for all their housing, and maybe not just religious. Though, again, all of this very heavily debated. Now, they also found these structures that were sometimes packed with multiple of the female or animal figurines, leading some to describe them as possibly early temples. And that's a possibility, but, you know, this is different than what you'll see in a lot of other temples in early, especially nearby settlements. Usually the god or goddess or the being that is being worshipped had their own abode. They did not share necessarily, unless it was a special occasion. There are instances where sometimes a god's would make a progression to join a family member, a divine family member, for a feast, or they would, you know, march among or be carried, or at least their statues would be carried among, you know, a thronging crowd as part of some type of ritual or religious celebration. So if that is the case, if these were kind of early religious buildings, they're different than what you'll see in places like further to the south or to the east or even in Egypt. So south or west and in places like in Egypt. Excuse me. Now, another thing that they are doing differently that is also thought to have a religious component is burial. Now, we've talked about how, in a lot of cases, at this early period, people are burying their dead underneath their homes. And in a few odd cases, you have people kind of burying people on the outskirts, like kind of all grouped together. Now, the Khalaf do bury the dead underneath their homes. However, I believe that in almost all of these cases, the bodies have been cremated to a certain extent. Not necessarily turned completely to ash. They probably couldn't get fires necessarily hot enough to do that completely. But they would burn enough of the body and the bones so that some of the bones were charred and things like that. And then those individuals would be kind of placed in urns. And then those would be buried under the home. And grave goods would be included with those bodies. However, the grave goods that were buried in those urns were deliberately or ritualistically destroyed. I don't know why they would do that. If this person is honored enough to be being buried underneath your home, you would expect, you know, their tools to be passed along, I guess, to their spirit. But maybe it was kind of like your body's been burnt, your tools are broken, you're now at rest. Maybe they don't need to do anything else in the afterlife. They're going to be taken care of, or maybe, I doubt it was something vengeful. Why would you bury someone who you wanted to punish under your home? Hard to say. I could only make guesses, and I can't come up with one for that specific explanation. But they would also bury people in graves on kind of the outskirts of their settlements. But they would bury, or they would dig shafts, these narrow shafts, and place the bodies in the shaft graves. This is something that you don't see anywhere else. It's led some to suggest that maybe the Halaf culture is coming from somewhere different. They maybe migrated into this region from somewhere else, because it is a lot different from the people who have been living here for the last at least 2,000 or 3,000 years. It's hard to say for sure, but that is one of the theories. And again, sometimes it's thought that maybe the people who were very skilled at making pottery, maybe they were the ones who were one of the people you might expect to find buried under the homes. Though again, that's speculation. Sometimes you find tools that maybe not you would expect a potter to have, but who knows. Now, another aspect of the Halaf sites that they all share in unison, or at least most of them. There are one or two exceptions, but almost all of these sites are above the rain line. There is a rain line where dry land agriculture can be practiced in this region, which means you plant your crops and it rains enough, usually rains enough every year for you to have enough of a harvest to survive and thrive on. You below this line, you would need to practice some type of irrigation to have large-scale population sustainability and growth. Hence, what you'll see when you get to the Mesopotamian city-states. Almost all of these cities are below this line, so they all need to have some form of irrigation process. The Halaf sites, they're all above the line. They're all, generally speaking, in places where they don't need river water to irrigate their crops. They can get by with just the natural rainfall. Now, there are one or two exceptions, but these are very rare, and they're all well south into Mesopotamia, so that you know they have access, conceivably, to river and irrigation stuff. Now, some of the Halaf sites above the line still are built near or founded near rivers or streams or things like that, Halaf being one of them. But they didn't need that water to water their crops. They probably just used it for themselves and for their animals. And the Halaf all had, in addition to agriculture, they all practiced sheep, goat, and cattle rearing. Now, another piece of the material culture that the Halaf had, and we're not 100% sure what it was used for, though we have a pretty good idea, is they created the stamp seal. These are very small. They're created in a variety of shapes and sizes, but no matter the shape or size, they were all incised with some type of pattern. Now, it is likely that this pattern was imprinted onto property, private property. At least that's the theory that I've seen thrown around the most often. Perhaps it's a maker's mark of some time, like, hey, I made this pottery, here's my mark on it, that kind of thing. Or, oh, let me put my mark on this basket or this pot filled with my ration of grain from the harvest. Or I think the Halaf grew a lot of emmer. At least that's the one that I think they grew the most of. So you would have, again, sometimes they were just simple circles. Sometimes they were a little bit more triangular or something along those lines. But they would all have their own personal patterns kind of etched into them. And that's your stamp. That's your seal. Yeah, you mark what is yours. At least that's the theory that I've seen thrown around. I didn't really see any alternatives put out there, though obviously not everyone agrees that private property was a thing this early, but who can say? But another interesting thing with the Halaf, there's not a whole lot of evidence for weapons or warfare. They do have some kind of spear points and things like that, or possibly arrowheads, maybe. Very, very few and far between. Now, you do see sling bullets, or pellets for slings, which is a very common weapon for herders and things like that. Pastoralists. A sling is something that you would see them carry around in a lot of popular imagination throughout all of history. But it's theorized that, you know, those were probably just used for hunting more than anything else. There's no real evidence of the remains that we found for the Halaf that they were particularly interested in warfare. There isn't a whole lot of evidence of individuals being killed by violence, at least human-on-human violence. Though, in some cases, it's kind of hard to tell. Who knows with those cremated remains? That may have destroyed certain evidence for that. I think there's only one instance of a large kind of communal grave. It was found like in an old well in, I think, what is now kind of the northeast of Iraq/Iran border area. And they found like 20, 24 bodies of individuals all dating to the Halaf period. And what killed them isn't really apparent. There are some who theorize that they were killed in a struggle, like in a fight. Though there are also people who say, no, it was probably a plague. They were probably buried there kind of away from everyone else to kind of make sure that there's no sickness spreading. Those are both theories. Those are what we know. That's what we know. Those are the two theories. We obviously don't know for sure, but there you have it. That site was called Tepe Galra, if I remember correctly. Now, as I said, the Halaf kind of coexist with a couple of other cultures, some of which we'll be discussing next time and some the time after. But right around 4500 BC, they kind of vanish. The ones kind of on the extremes of their territory, either to the northwest, like Halaf itself, and kind of the ones further north in the Taurus mountain areas, these all kind of fall by the wayside or abandoned or are taken over by another culture, the Ubaid culture. Now, we'll discuss the Ubaid in a little bit more detail, probably the episode after the next. But these, slowly but surely, the Ubaid material culture just becomes more prominent. And it kind of phases out the Halaf sites. Though, again, there appears to be at least some level of population continuity in some of the Halaf sites. It's just the Ubaid culture kind of wins out. Why that is, we'll guess, talk about when we talk about those people. The Halaf culture also does adopt some level of copper working. This is towards the end of their period, though, very late. I think only within the last 4,700 to the 4,500 do you really see it turn up. But they had access to copper from the Taurus Mountains, one of their sites, or a site very closely associated with them. There is some copper. I believe it's Urgani is the name of the site now. So they may have been one of the early importers of copper into Mesopotamia proper. But that being said, next time we're going to be talking about two other cultures, probably two. We may have to break them both up into their own episodes like we did with the Halaf, but we'll be talking about the Hassuna and the Samara cultures. These are also two overlapping cultures along with each other. They overlap with the Halaf and the Ubaid. And I'm looking forward to talking about them. I hope you will join me doing so. They start, I think, technically before both the Ubaid and the Halaf, but they don't occupy nearly as much space as the other two, and they only last around 500 years or so each, whereas the Halaf and the Ubaid, they have their genesis maybe a couple hundred years before 6000 BC, but those at least last 1,000 years, the Halaf and the Ubaid. There are those that argue they exist a little bit more than that, maybe 1,200, maybe 1,500, but we'll talk about that next time. So, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have any questions or feedback or constructive criticism, please feel free to let me know. You can contact me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can send me a direct message on X/Twitter, or you can come into my YouTube streams when I am live and comment there, or you can comment on the YouTube videos themselves. It may take me a day or two sometimes to read those, but I do check fairly regularly. So, thank you all. I hope everyone, again, is safe and well with the weather here in the Southeast. And for those outside the Southeast, I just hope you're safe and well in general. I appreciate you all stopping by, downloading, liking, subscribing, rating, all that kind of good stuff. Thank you all. I appreciate it so, so much. I hope you all have a good rest of your day and a rest of your week. Till next time, peace.